Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley and this is the show every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio that gets you thinking, and we're going to be doing that in the company of influential sociologist of religion, Rodney Stark, today. Special Q&A edition of the programme. Before we get to that, sad news this last week of the passing away of Nabil Qureshi, well-known convert from Islam to Christianity with a thriving apologetics ministry, but diagnosed about a year ago with advanced stomach cancer. He finally did pass away on Saturday, the 16th of September, leaving behind a wife and child. We're going to be speaking later on in the programme to David Wood, a very good friend of Nabil's and someone involved in his conversion, just celebrating really his life, ministry and his story, which continues to touch so many. So do listen out for that towards the end of today's programme, an extended conversation with David Wood. Also, straight after today's programme, we're going to be re-airing a long-form interview I had with Nabil before he was diagnosed with cancer, that was first broadcast back in 2016. So you can hear that on the profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon, and available on the profile podcast as well. Simply search for that on whatever podcast software you use and you'll be able to hear my profile interview with Nabil Qureshi from about 18 months ago. If you don't know already, you can access the whole of the Unbelievable archive and today's programme, of course, at the webpage premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to all kinds of things, including, of course, this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and MP3 CD and available as a digital download. Also, of course, links to the Unbelievable book and exciting news on that front. I'm going to be at a special Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic discussion group in London on Monday, the 9th of October. This is very much a group that grew organically out of the Unbelievable show. It's not in any way organised by myself, but by listeners of the show. I've never actually been able to attend up till this point as well, and it's been going a couple of years. Tries to meet monthly. Well, I will be there on Monday, the 9th of October. It's at Somerstown Coffee House. That's between King's Cross and Euston Stations in London. 60 Cholton Street, London, from 7:30 in the evening through to 9:30. And I'm going to be explaining why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. Indeed, that's the subtitle of my book, which will be available there. I'll be signing some copies as well. If you can get along, do check out the information about it at the meetup.com website. Simply search for Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. And again, if you want to get hold of signed copies of the book, Unbelievable, Why? After 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian, as well as the audiobook and other links as well, it's all available from the website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Let's get into today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I'm very excited to be joined on the programme today by Rodney Stark. In an Ask Rodney Stark Anything edition of the programme, I put out a call on social media and via this programme for you to send your questions in for Rodney, and we're going to be hearing them across the course of today's programme. Rodney Stark is a distinguished sociologist of religion. He's joining me on the show today. He's professor at Baylor University and co-director there of the Institute for Studies of Religion. Author of over 30 books, including, of course, the seminal book The Rise of Christianity, published in 1996. And other books along the way have shed new light on the way the Christian church grew from its inception. And he's gone on to write about the enormous contribution of Christianity to Western civilization, as well as exploding a few secular myths along the way. And indeed, his latest book takes on a few more myths. It's called Reformation Myths. And as we celebrate, of course, 500 years of the Reformation being marked in various ways around the world, Rodney's book is looking at what the Reformation did and didn't do for the world. In fact, it's subtitled Five Centuries of Misconceptions and Some Misfortunes, published here in the UK by SBCK. And as well as talking to us about his influential books and how they've impacted his own personal view of faith, I'll be asking him questions that you, the Unbelievable audience, have sent in via email, social media and other ways as well. So welcome along to the programme, Rodney. Great to have you on the show today.
I'm delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you on. Rodney, I've admired your work from afar for quite some time, and your name frequently crops up when we feature some of the debates and dialogues on the impact of Christianity on the world. And in many ways, I think many people would say there has been something of a secular story about the way Christianity kind of plunged us into a dark ages, which the Enlightenment finally rescued us from, and we're all on our way to a happy secular future. But I know that many of your books have challenged that particular narrative. How did you yourself end up writing and researching in the whole area of the history and sociology of religion?
It was really quite by accident. I had been a newspaper reporter, and I went to graduate school at Berkeley, University of California. And from there, I was hired into their survey research center. And we had a big grant to study that ended up with us being able to design the first national samples to study American religion. And it was just the opportunity. I mean, I kind of just lucked into it. And one thing has led to another, and turns out it was fun. and there you are.
What was your view of Christian faith and the history of Christianity when you began your research, and has it changed significantly in the decades since?
Well, I don't know as much that it's changed as much as I've built a knowledge. I mean, I was fairly ignorant of the history of Christianity as a young sociologist. I mean, I grew up in a Lutheran church, and you know, every Sunday we sang "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God" and heard about what a terrible church the Roman Catholics were, and that was about the extent of my understanding of religious history. And I just kind of, you know, once I started working in the area, I started reading and thinking, and one thing led to another.
This won't be the focus of our conversation, but I am inclined to ask my guests about their own personal religious convictions. I mean, would you say that your religious convictions have changed alongside your study and interest in Christian history as well?
Certainly. I, like most young sociologists, wasn't a believer. I was never an atheist, but I guess you'd have to call me really a cultural Christian. That is to say, I always was committed to Western civilization and its values and my interest in its history. But I wasn't really, I didn't go to church. I wasn't really a believer. And I've slowly written my way to being kind of an independent Christian.
It's an interesting phrase to use for that. And I've had questions along these lines, actually. I'll dig into a couple of them now as we've reached this subject. Christopher asks, I understand Professor Stark was not a Christian when he wrote his earlier work on the history and sociology of religion, but became a believer later, and asks if he could share his faith journey and whether his academic research played a role. And Jordan, in similar vein, asks, what one book have you written that best explains why you became a Christian? Now, I'm not aware you have written a book that explains why you are a Christian, and perhaps you could explain what you mean by the phrase independent Christian, and just how your research has led you on that journey.
Well, I don't think any of my books really explain anything about how I became a Christian. They're all focused on history and on the impact of faith and how it's changed the world and affected things. Independent Christian, I mean, I think what that means is I'm not committed to a denomination. I mean, I think my religion is one that's best described as private.
Well, we'll leave it there then. But thank you very much for joining me on the program today. And we're going to dig in the course of today's program to the historical and sociological work you've done in the area of the history of religion. And if you're listening and you'd like to comment and feedback on any of the issues that we're touching on in today's program, we'll be covering issues like the Reformation, obviously, in light of Rodney's latest book. Also, the rise and impact of Christianity, science and other issues as well. Then you can always email the program, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send your emails. I'll try and read as many out on forthcoming programmes as I can. You can also, of course, get in touch via our social media. At UnbelievableJB is the Twitter account, I should say. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page for the show. Do get in touch. Let us know what you think about today's programme.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking with Rodney Stark on Unbelievable today, distinguished sociologist of religion and a professor at Baylor University, where he's co-director of the Institute for Studies of Religion, author of many influential books, including, of course, The Rise of Christianity. And his latest is on Reformation myths, 5 centuries of misconceptions and some misfortunes. So it's an Ask Rodney Stark Anything edition of the show today. You've been sending in your questions for him via Facebook, email and Twitter. And why don't we start with the Reformation, Rodney, as that's the subject of your latest book. Obviously, this is the year to bring out a Reformation book. Do you want to briefly, though, explain what your book offers that some of perhaps the other books that are coming out this year on the Reformation and Martin Luther perhaps don't offer? And what's the unique, if you like, thesis of this particular book?
Well, perhaps the best way to approach it is to tell you how I came to write the book. I did a book last year called Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. The British publisher of that book then approached me and said, look, we would like to suggest that you do a book on the Reformation that we can bring out in the year celebrating the 500th anniversary of the nailing of the 95 Theses to the church door, etc. And what we would like is your notions on the incorrect views of the Reformation. As I say in the preface of the book, they really are asking me to be the skunk at the picnic, if you will, to come along and suggest that not everything was wonderful about the Reformation. And, of course, there are lots of things that can be said. There are some incorrect views. One is the claim that somehow the Reformation caused the rise of capitalism. I mean, it's the famous Max Weber Protestant ethic thesis. Well, it's wrong. And it's scholars have known it was wrong since the day it was published. Sociologists don't seem to understand that. But the fact is, within several years of its publication, important historians were saying this is nonsense because capitalism was fully developed centuries before the Reformation. Therefore, the Reformation couldn't have had anything to do with it. And, of course, they're right. And in Weber's time, when he was arguing that, well, the Protestant nations are way ahead of the Catholic nations in terms of industrialization, that wasn't so. There's an enormous body of research showing that all of this is simply nonsense. So I had to do a chapter on that. A second similar thesis was that Protestantism caused the rise of science, that suddenly the Reformation freed people from the narrow strictures of this repressive Catholic faith, and suddenly science was able to leap forward. Nonsense. First of all, if you look at the leading scholar, we're talking about that so-called scientific revolution of the 17th century. If you look at the time and the place, Catholics were as active and as prominent in this so-called revolution as were any Protestants. It's true that that the British probably played a disproportionate role, and of course that's a Protestant country, but that has really nothing to do with it. And when all is said and done, what you have is no revolution at all, but simply the wonderful flowering of conventional science having built up over centuries in Catholic universities, which they were all Catholic until Martin Luther came along.
Indeed. I mean, that's a really helpful indication of a couple of the areas you cover in the book and the myths about what the Reformation gave us that you're tackling here. I mean, one question maybe just to start us off as well in this topic comes from, I think it's pronounced Suanlal Zhu, asks, what for you, Rodney, is the heart of the Reformation? Is it political, economic, artistic, theological? How would you try to encapsulate the heart of the Reformation?
Oh, I think it was theological. Of course, it depends on which Reformation you're talking about. I mean, Luther taught salvation is by faith alone. Calvin taught is there is no effective faith or works on salvation, that God decides who's going to be saved, and we don't have any idea why that is. And, of course, Henry VIII in his so-called Reformation took a straight Catholic view, which is works and faith both.
I mean, obviously, you know, it is theological in that sense, and those who are often celebrating it in the circles I move in are celebrating what they see as a return to the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith alone and so on. I mean, obviously, though, do you believe that the Reformation did usher in a new kind of political age or economic age? Or do you think those things already existed, as you say, but we've kind of conveniently ascribed them to
I think it was very important. The reason is that what the Reformations did agree on was they all rejected the Pope and the Pope's authority. And what that meant was the final destruction of what had been known as Christendom for centuries, which is that there was kind of an international religion uniting all of the various royal courts. Kings were answerable to their confessors. And it's amazing how many times we see evidence that the church imposed limits on kings and other nobility. I mean, part of the reason of the Crusades was that Christian pilgrims to the Holy Land were being abused. And, of course, these were primarily the nobility, or at least the aristocrats. But, I mean, there were, you know, your confessor would say, you know, that was a terrible thing and you need to stop doing it. And then sometimes they would say, and you've got to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem or you won't be forgiven. It was clear that the church was a break on royal power. When that disappeared, kings in the Protestant countries tended also to become the heads of church. And so we got state churches that were just as repressive, if not more so, than anything the Catholic Church had ever been. There was no religious freedom. You could not be even a resident of most of the Scandinavian nations unless you belonged to the state church. There were periods in which church attendance was mandatory and you were fined for not attending. Wasn't very successful, but there it was. This was not an age of religious freedom. This was an age of state churches, which, by the way, I think the remains of which are still to be seen all over Europe, because it made for weak churches. That is, the public didn't respond very well to state churches. Religion does much better when there are a bunch of religions around, or denominations. Tailoring their message to different segments of the population and competing with one another for followers. State churches are lazy. You know, I mean, if it's a state church, you know, each clergyman, the check comes whether people come or not. And as you can see in much of Europe, the check does come and nobody is coming. All of this goes back to the collapse of Christendom and the formation of state churches and ultimately of much, much more powerful rulers, because there was no confessor around, no church around, no pope around to put any brakes on.
Do you, I mean, obviously you've outlined, and rightly so, because it's the topic of your book, some of the bad side of the Reformation. I mean, if you were to at least outline one positive, what would you hold up as perhaps one of the most positive things, Chris, well, the world has received?
that out of it did come pluralism. The kings were not necessarily all that successful in imposing the state churches, so that today there is religious choice. Great Britain, I think there are at least 500 different Protestant denominations. In the United States, there are more than 1,000. In sub-Saharan Africa, there are more than 10,000. And the impact of that has been very positive in terms of enlisting the religious commitment of the population.
Sure. Just to go to some of the specifics of the reformers themselves, I've got a couple of questions here. Firstly, Nathaniel asks, just how univocal was the Reformation? Modern Protestants are in the habit of asserting certain central Lutheran and Calvinist doctrines and referring to them as reformational. Is this accurate, or was there more dissent among reformers than we're led to believe?
Well, they didn't like one another. And
some things never change.
Yes, and it turns out that there was an enormous amount of repression going on. I mean, they were constantly finding heretics in their midst and having to put them down, or failing to put them down in the, as pluralism begins to develop. I mean, when the Wesley brothers at Oxford became Methodists, nobody hanged them. And some important religious history developed.
John Calvin asks Clay Jones, is often portrayed as overbearing, dictatorial, and unwilling to overlook a slight. How true do you think that is?
Well, I think Calvin was, in fact, a very narrow, self-centered man. I mean, he was very repressive. You know, his own daughter and son-in-law got executed for adultery. I mean, it was not a nice time in Switzerland.
Obviously, the overall theme that I'm obviously getting from you here, Rodney, and obviously from the book is that we should be careful of ascribing too much to the Reformation, and equally we need to be realistic about the people at the centre of it and what happened. I mean, when it comes to that central theological idea, though, that Martin Luther had of salvation by faith, do you think that that was a necessary, something that the Catholic Church needed to hear at that time, at that point in its history?
I don't really know. I think that in the long run, the Reformation probably did more good for the Catholic Church than anything else that had happened in the last 1,000 years. It's been very good for the Catholic Church. First of all, with the Counter-Reformation, was an enormous revival of the Catholic Church. But much more recently, the competition of Protestantism has had enormously positive effects for the Church in various parts of the world, particularly in Latin America. In the 20th century, Protestant missionaries managed to become legal in a number of Latin American countries, and as a result, they started getting converts, and Protestantism began growing in Latin America. And the Church's initial response wasn't effective. It was called liberation theology, and somehow they had some kind of weak Marxism combined with kind of weak Catholicism, and everything was going to be wonderful, but nothing happened. But then they started copying some of the techniques, such as revival and charismatic sessions and whatnot of their Protestant competitors. And the Catholic Church in Latin America over the last 30 years has boomed at an incredible level. Mass attendance used to be so very, very low in Latin America. Now it's astonishingly high, 50, 60, 70% of Catholics are going to Mass every Sunday. This is astonishing. And for a continent that never could provide itself with priests, suddenly the seminaries are full. It's quite
a remarkable story. Gone hand in hand, as you say, with the rise of the Pentecostal denominations and churches in Latin America.
if you look in inside Latin America, the stronger the Protestants, the stronger the Catholics. And see, where there are more Protestants, the Catholics are going to church at a higher rate.
That's a very interesting indication, isn't it? I've got just one more question before we go to a break. This comes from a Catholic, Peter Sean Bradley. Says, first of all, he commends your last book, Bearing False Witness, which he wrote a review of on Amazon and is the most, liked review of the book there on the Amazon page for the book. So he gives a quick synopsis of it. Says, Stark's last two books, Bearing False Witness and Reformation Myths, have been surprisingly friendly to Catholicism. In Bearing False Witness, Stark debunks the typical atheist myths about Catholicism, namely anti-Semitism, the non-canonical gospels, persecution of pagans, the Dark Ages, the Crusades, the Inquisition, religion and the rise of science, slavery, the Catholic Church and fascism, and the Catholic Church's alleged social stagnation. In Reformation Myths, Stark takes on the triumphalistic myths of Protestantism that paint Catholicism as anti-science, anti-individualism, anti-capitalist, anti-democratic, etc. I take it that Stark is offended by bad history, which is proper, but I wonder if he has taken a Catholic-friendly attitude because he understands that the Catholic historical limb that is being carved away is the same limb that supports Christianity as a viable social project. I mean, it does sound like you have become very open to the fact that Catholicism, in your view, has a great deal to offer and continue to offer, I suppose, in terms of its historical legacy.
Well, I see it as an important aspect of Christianity. I don't see it as a superior faith in any sense. I'm not Catholic. I grew up in a Lutheran church in which we heard terrible stories about Catholics every Sunday. And all I was concerned about were an enormous number of, quite simply, lies. You know, I mean, these things weren't true. For example, every competent historian today knows there were no Dark Ages. Every encyclopedia admits that the Dark Ages were a myth. And yet I still look up and I pick up my newspaper and I see people referring to the Dark Ages when the Catholic Church shut everything down and we all, lived in a little unlit world, as William Manchester called it. Nonsense. Enormous progress took place during this so-called dark period. We went into it probably behind China and various parts of the world in terms of a lot of technology. When we emerge from, quote, the Dark Ages, Europe is way ahead of the rest of the world. How did that happen? During this long, dark, dumb age, we made all of this intellectual progress? I mean, come on. It's silliness.
And just
the Dark Ages never happened.
Before we go to that break, why do you think then is this myth being perpetuated in certain secular circles? What's the reason for people wanting to keep that particular narrative alive?
Well, there are two. One is simply anti-Catholic, based on traditional Protestantism and the fact that these things still prosper in Protestant countries like Great Britain and the United States. And secondly, of course, the anti-religious crowd loves it and promulgates it. But that doesn't mean that there's anything there. It's all nonsense.
We're going to go to a break, and we're talking on Unbelievable today to Rodney Stark, distinguished sociologist of religion, author of books such as The Rise of Christianity. His latest one is Reformation Myths, available here in the UK from SBCK. I'll make sure there are links to Rodney and his books on the Unbelievable page of the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for today's show. You can leave comments there and find out how to get in touch with the programme as well. We'll be continuing to ask your questions of my special guest on today's programme, Rodney Stark, in just a moment's time.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity. From a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's show. We'll be continuing to ask your questions of Rodney Stark, the influential sociologist of religion, author of books like The Rise of Christianity, in a moment's time. And don't forget, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's show, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via Twitter and Facebook at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow us on Facebook. All of those links and more available from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to helpful resources, articles, features, and of course the Unbelievable Conference on DVD and digital download, and of course the Unbelievable book too can be found there. Also, just a quick reminder that I'll be speaking in the third part of today's show to David Wood, a good friend of Nabil Qureshi, who passed away a week ago, Saturday the 16th of September, after a prolonged battle with stomach cancer. He was an influential Christian convert from Islam with a thriving apologetics ministry. David's going to be remembering Nabil and talking through some of those questions as well. Many people are asking about why would God allow someone like Nabil to be taken in the prime of his life with wife and young child and such a thriving ministry ahead of him. Do listen out for that towards the end of today's show. So Rodney, thanks again for being with me. Now, we want to talk about the rise of Christianity and indeed the triumph of Christianity and what it's done for the Western world, in your view. A number of questions came in on this particular subject. Here's one from Keith Mason, who's a big fan of yours, and he told me that on Facebook. Says, I guess I'd be interested in knowing, across all of Rodney's work, what are the distinctives of Christianity that have allowed it to impact the world in the way it has, in ways that other beliefs have not? This is obviously broad brush stuff, but what are the distinctives of Christianity as opposed to other worldviews and religions that have allowed Christianity to impact the world in the way it has?
Well, first of all, I think you have to see that the whole basis is the conception of God. I mean, that's the key, that you've got a God who is all-seeing, all-knowing, who has moral concerns, who is aware of the individual, who is the creator. In other words, an unlimited God, as opposed, say, to Zeus or Saturn or Venus and whatnot, which were little tiny gods, quite human in their failings, unedifying in their morality, etc., etc. And along this line, it's important to realize something historically, which is Judaism might very well have swept across the Western world the way Christianity ultimately did, except for one thing, which is the limit was that you had to become an ethnic Jew in order to become a religious Jew. And when it was decided that Paul would be given the right to convert pagans to Christianity without them first becoming Jews, that was the big revolutionary step. Now you could be a Gallic Jew, a Roman Jew, a Greek Jew, whatever. And you didn't, Christianity. You didn't have to be a Jewish Jew. You had to be, the ethnic thing was out. And that's what freed Christianity to spread. Otherwise, remember, Judaism was extremely successful as a missionizing faith, so much so that the Romans persecuted them intensely and frequently. But the big breakthrough came when you had a universal religion in terms of ethnicity. And that freed the whole thing. And Christianity is obviously so superior to the pagan religions, in terms of, for example, morality. Going to, a pagan temple certainly doesn't instill any morality, because you're talking about gods who are immoral. I mean, they cheated and stole and lied and raped and did all sorts of terrible things. They were not edifying. Secondly, there's no conception of an attractive afterworld in these pagan faiths. Christianity was offering people a God who cared, a God who was concerned, and the possibility of an afterlife, of an unhappy afterlife, indeed, if one were too much of a sinner. And it was a basis for building a new world.
I mean, I've got a question here from Yamil, who asks along these lines. In your book, The Rise of Christianity, which he says is a great book for the record, you conclude by saying that what Christianity gave to their converts was nothing else than their humanity. And Yamil asks, I wonder what he means here by humanity, when his sociological approach is accounted for in applying the basic tenets of neoclassical economic theory to religion. Is he granting Christianity a holistically comprehensive value for what it means to be human? And how was that different from other religions at the time?
Well, in the context in which I wrote that, I had just been writing about the Roman amphitheater, and how an emperor gave his son games for his birthday, in which, of course, thousands of people died. That watching people kill each other was considered a marvelous entertainment for a boy's birthday. And the notion that this was wrong, that human life has value, and that it is not a trivial thing to be taken away by mere whims, by rulers and whatnot, was enormously humanizing. It meant that human life was valuable and meaningful, and not to be taken lightly. And that's what I meant about giving people their humanity. That, it makes clear that even the lowest among us, as the Bible tells us, has virtue and value.
And this was part of the key to its popularity, in your view, because it reached to the lowest classes in ways that perhaps other religions that were based on an emperor or whoever, it was able to appeal?
Yes, but it also transformed the privileged. And I think that made it very, very important, because sociologists are wrong about seeing religions as great movements of the unwashed and the down under. Most religious movements are started by the privileged, who are finding a lack of meaning and a lack of value in the religion of their time. And the way that the outlook of the privileged was transformed was very important as well. Consider that the great religious movements of more recent times, such as Methodism and whatnot, were started by people who had privilege and who were concerned by the lack of virtue that they perceived in the world around them. They wanted something more, something clearer and something cleaner. And we're talking, say, about the Wesley brothers or indeed Martin Luther.
I suppose the other religion that could make claim to having done the most spreading in the world since its inception is Islam, which obviously came centuries after Christianity. But what for you are the defining differences between the way in which Christianity spread and the way Islam spread?
Well, Islam has spread mostly with the sword. North Africa was Christian. The Muslim armies conquered it. And it took centuries for it to become a Muslim. They weren't all that conversionist. They were simply fairly repressive. It's not spreading today through conversion. the people who say that, that Islam is going to be more new, that Muslims will be more numerous than Christians in another X generations because of greater fertility are wrong, and they're missing two things. One is that Muslim fertility is falling very rapidly in response to modernization for the same reason Christians did. And secondly, Islam doesn't grow by conversion, and Christianity has, for the last 100 years, been growing enormously by conversion. I mean, I have a book on China, and there are an awful lot of Christians suddenly in China. It's done by conversion, and it's very important.
Well, and that leads us nicely on to other questions regarding the future of Christianity. Keith asks, I'd be interested in your speculation on the future of Christianity in the world. And also, Morris asks, what is the future of Christianity in the Western world? And what can we do to keep its influence as we have in the past? Now, where the places you're pointing to in terms of the growth of Christianity today are obviously outside of the West, in the East, South America, yes, places like that. So what about Christianity in the West? Are we seeing the end of the rise of Christianity now in the West? Or do you think it still has room to grow and new forms of Christianity arise?
Well, the first thing we've got to realize is that the notion of the decline of Christianity in the West is largely a myth. There was an Anglican clergyman back in the 1700s who predicted that Christianity would be gone by 1900. And Voltaire said that he was much, much too pessimistic, that Christianity would be gone in 50 years, which would have been about 1820, 1810. Nothing happened. Mm. The fact is that for various reasons that I go on at length about, the churches in Europe were never full. It isn't that they're standing empty now. They always stood empty. There are all kinds of hostile letters coming down to the local level saying, you've got to put the church back in order and stop having, using it to shelter your cattle. The Lutherans put out a lot of inspectors to visit local congregations, and they wrote thousands and thousands of reports, which all still exist and have been looked at by historians. And they found nobody was in church. Local pastors were complaining that sometimes they didn't even preach their sermon because nobody was there. So that when we talk about empty churches, we're talking about something that's not new. It's not been a big decline. They never built it up. On the other hand, in other parts of the world, including the Western world, as it extends to the Western Hemisphere, religion is very strong. Americans are even much more religious than people thought they were. We've recently discovered that the censuses of American churches have underestimated by 20 to 30% the number of actual congregations in this country, which is quite remarkable. But Latin America's church, sub-Saharan Africa is, my Lord, church attendance down there is staggering. And as my colleague Philip Jenkins talks about the growth of Christianity, what he calls the global south, which is not really south of the equator, most of it, but it's about Asia, for example, and Africa. Enormous growth going on. So the notion of the secularization of the world. British historians have in the past 15 years turned their backs on the secularization thesis, claiming it was wrong, that it was misguided, that it mistook church religion for personal religion, and shows that, all these people who aren't going to church are still busy praying.
So just to be clear, the secularization thesis you refer to, is that broadly speaking the view that the West is becoming increasingly secularized in terms of people's personal beliefs and faith commitments.
Right, that religion's going away.
Yes.
Because
I've had a
couple.
I've had a couple of questions, both asking actually the same question, really. Christopher Adams asks, what's the best answer to those who say that recent American polling, including the new PRRI survey, validates the secularization thesis in the world's most advanced countries? And Josh Parikh says, what does he think about the work of Steve Bruce, suggesting that the secularization thesis is legitimate, particularly in a UK context? So this is kind of looking at
I have
specific...
never agreed with one thing that Steve Bruce ever wrote.
Okay.
He's a fun guy, but you know, he's been beating this drum forever, and the drum doesn't thump. The so-called rise of the religious nun in the United States is largely nonsense, and the problem going on with polling is that polling is washed up in the United States. I must say that the people at the Pew Research Institute, when they do their national surveys, and they report all these things like decline in the number of Christians and whatnot, they're honest about their most important thing, which is their return rate. It's running 9 and 10%. That is to say, you draw a sample of, say, 1,000 people, and you go out to interview them, and you end up getting about 90 of the people who were drawn in your sample who are willing to be interviewed. And so you've got to keep drawing and drawing and drawing in order to get your 1,000 people. Well, when I was in graduate school, it was believed that if you didn't get at least 85% of a take rate on a survey, you could throw the survey away as meaningless. Well, these surveys aren't being thrown away, but in fact, they're pretty meaningless. And one of the things we do know is that it's the lower-income people who are agreeing to participate disproportionately. Those people never belong to church. Church membership has been a middle- and upper-class thing all along. The down-and-out, they're not irreligious. And these, by the way, these people who say they don't belong to a church overwhelmingly pray. So, I mean, not being a church member is not the same thing as being an atheist by any means.
Hmm. It's very interesting. Let's move on to some other questions. We're asking Rodney Stark, my guest on Unbelievable today, a variety of questions you sent in as listeners. Rodney Stark, a distinguished sociologist of religion. His latest book, by the way, Reformation Myths, out, of course, this special anniversary year, 500 years since, supposedly at least, Martin Luther nailed those 95 theses to the castle church door of Wittenberg. But we've moved on in the course of this program to talking about your general analysis of religion across the world and through history and so on. Here's another question, which really takes us to sort of the rise of the many different religions in America. This one is from David Riggs, who says, it seems that the mid-1800s gave birth to many competing religions, such as Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, even Darwinism and others. What was happening at that time so that so many of these new religious movements got started around that time? What do you have an idea for why that was a particularly fertile period for seeing these different types of religious movements begin, Rodney?
It wasn't.
Another myth?
No, new religions start in the United States constantly, always have, partly because of freedom. I mean, it's you don't go to jail for doing it. What was different is that the Mormons succeeded. There were tons of other groups, and they've just, you know, they just disappeared. The Jehovah's Witnesses, by the way, are not a new religion. They are a very standard form of Christianity, and they've gotten a bad rap because they come and visit and knock on your door, and that they did believe that the world was going to end. But Christians have long, there are all kinds of Christian groups who've believed that we're living in the last days. The Witnesses are a remarkable bunch of people, as a matter of fact, and they publish wonderful statistics, which sociologists like to have. And by the way, their statistics are reliable because they show when there's a decline in a country as well as an increase, which is really very nice.
Yes. And the Mormons have done their part for certainly genealogical sort of research.
The Mormons are a marvelous exception. I mean, they were a group that made it. And I've had a lot of contact with them. It's a remarkable denomination because it's a denomination of laymen. I mean, there are no Mormon ordained priests, if you will. All Mormon men are priests, and it's an amazing thing.
I mean,
church that's run by people who were busy running corporations until they were 50 or 60. And that makes for a very different view at the top, and some awfully.
I was going to ask though in this context, and again, this takes us from the academic study of religion to the more metaphysical question about whether there's anything behind it. But one atheist who listened to the program gets in touch. It's Ed who says, "My question is, to me, the observations of church history with all the schisms, Christian on Christian persecutions, vast array of conflicting doctrines. Is that's just what one would expect if it was just human history with no divine involvement. The observations are also very surprising if there is a God behind all this church history. Does Rodney agree? Is this evidence against a God behind all this, in your view, Rodney?
No, or? It's evidence that of a God who gave free will and doesn't interfere.
Right.
Doesn't, you know, I mean, so you've got humans who are free to... And when people start studying Scripture, on the one hand, there's going to be a lot of disagreement. Two, human ambition is going to mean that there are a lot of people who see it as their job to lead a schism or to lead a dispute or start a new denomination. These are all very predictable and very human sorts of things. I don't think that it... tells us anything about a God behind history, as Christianity has always conceived this God, which is not a God who's sitting there calling the shots.
Let's just, with the small amount of remaining time we have, briefly talk about your thesis on the way that Christianity, in many ways, gave rise to modern science. A couple of people wanted to ask questions around that. Vince says, I want to hear more on your assertion of how Christianity, as opposed to, say, Islam or paganism, gave rise to modern science. Wasn't a lot of science influenced by Greek philosophy, like atomism? Christian philosophers reinvoked those ideas, but would it not have happened in other cultures eventually? And Andrew Blaycock asks, how does he respond to critics such as Ronald Numbers, who say that his reading of the Christian origins of science are revisionist? So let's just hear briefly, as we start to close out today's program, your defense of the Christian origins of modern science.
Well, it's not really a very original position of mine, but the fact is that while the Greeks did have some science, they also had a lot of anti-science built into their view. It's not at all clear to me that they were going much of anywhere. They had more than science, they had some technology, really. But in order to have science, you've got to believe that the universe runs according to rules and that these rules are discoverable. Almost all non-Christian, non-Jewish religions have dismissed that idea as silly. The universe can't be comprehended, that it's mysterious and beyond human comprehension. And it's really only the Judeo-Christian tradition that has held it is comprehensible because God created it according to rational rules. It's a rational God. And that's what, you know, these early scientists, famous people, all said they were doing. They said, you know, we're trying to discover the rules by which he made it. And it turns out they could, which was a marvelous thing. But we forget, for example, that Newton wrote a whole lot more theology than he ever wrote science. Mm. These were very, very religious men, most of them. And they saw that what they were doing is a calling from God. And it turns out that's the way things worked. It was possible to discover these rules. So that's no longer a matter of philosophy or of hope or belief. It's pretty obvious.
Well, it's been really great to be able to talk with you across all of these different areas. Thank you very much, Rodney, for joining me on the program today. I've long wanted to have
you. I was delighted to be with you.
It was lovely to have you on. Long wanted to have you on the show, so thank you very much. Again, I'll make sure there are links to Rodney's books and where you can find out more about him from today's webpage. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And if you're interested in looking at the myths that are often perpetuated about the Reformation in this anniversary year, then why not get hold of a copy of Reformation Myths, 5 Centuries of Misconceptions and Some Misfortunes, available now. Again, links to that book from the radio show website. But for the moment, Rodney, thank you very much for being my guest on this edition of the program.
Delighted to have been with you.
Hope you can stay here on Unbelievable. Coming up in the final part of today's show, we're going to be reflecting on the life of Nabil Qureshi, a well-known convert from Islam to Christianity and a Christian apologist who passed away last Saturday after losing his battle with stomach cancer. I'll be speaking to David Wood, who was a good friend of Nabil's, in fact, very much involved in his conversion to Christianity. And we'll be hearing Nabil on The Profile straight after Unbelievable this afternoon.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and just a reminder that straight after today's show, I'll be back with The Profile. Today, re-airing an interview I had with Islamic convert to Christianity, Nabil Qureshi, who sadly passed away last Saturday. We're going to be remembering his life by hearing again his story of how that happened. And I'm going to be speaking in just a moment to David Wood, a good friend of his who was very much involved in his conversion, about Nabil's life as we remember him. Just a reminder as well, though, that if you are interested in the whole world of Unbelievable, if you've been following this program for some time and you're within reach of London, you might be interested in turning up, perhaps for the first time, to the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. It's a monthly meeting, covers all kinds of interesting topics with all kinds of speakers, but I'll be speaking there for the first time on Monday, the 9th of October, meeting at the Somerstown Coffee House. It's a pub between King's Cross and Euston stations. That's at 7:30 in the evening on Monday, the 9th of October, talking about why I'm still a Christian. And of course, I'll make sure there are copies of my new book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. And of course, there'll be Q&A and a chance to discuss. It tends to be organised by both Christians and non-Christians, people who listen to the show. And of course, that's the audience who turn up as well. So if you can get along, do check out the details at the meetup.com website. Look for Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. And if you want to find the book yourself, you can't make it to that particular meeting, it's available online, of course. You can get yourself a free taster chapter as well. You can find the audio book, and you can even get yourself a signed copy if you order it direct from our website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. Next week on the program, looking forward to being joined by Andrew Copson, who heads up Humanists UK. That's the new name for the British Humanist Association. He's written a new book on secularism, and he's going to be debating it with Peter Hitchens. He's a well-known character, a columnist, of course, for the Mail on Sunday, known as well, of course, for being the brother of the late Christopher Hitchens. But Peter, very much a Christian, and always an interesting guest on this program when we have it on. That should be quite a feisty interaction, I imagine. Andrew Copson and Peter Hitchens debating secularism on next week's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, tributes have been pouring in this last week, of course, to Nabil Qureshi, the life he lived. He died aged 34 last Saturday after over a year of battling cancer. And he was a guest on this show on a number of occasions. I had the privilege of meeting him in person a couple of times as well. And it's certainly been something which, at least in the apologetics and theology circles that I move in, has affected people deeply, his passing away. So I thought it appropriate to, as well as the fact that we'll be playing out the interview I recorded with him over a year ago on The Profile straight after today's programme, I thought it would be good to invite one of the people who knew him best to talk to us about his life and legacy. That's David Wood, who was very much involved in Nabil's journey to faith and has been a friend ever since of his, has been a partner in ministry with him, and indeed a popular photo that was circulated a great deal around the time of Nabil's passing away showed Nabil rising up from the waters of baptism, and the man behind him is David Wood, who was there to baptise him. David, thank you for joining me on the programme.
Hey, how's it going, Justin?
Very well, thank you. And appreciate this is obviously a difficult time for the family of Nabil, but also for his friends as well. And you were a great friend of Nabil's. Do you mind telling us sort of how you first bumped into each other and what your first memories are of Nabil?
Well, we had both joined the speech and debate team in college. And so we'd seen each other briefly at the meetings, but hadn't talked to each other. But I noticed that he was a Muslim, so I was interested in talking to him. But all I knew at that point was that he had a Muslim name. I didn't know if he was actually, you know, practicing Muslim. And eventually we went to a tournament where you go to another college and then you're going to, compete in events. And we got to the hotel room and I saw him putting away his prayer rug. And so I was thinking, okay, he's at least devout enough to pray. Mm-hmm. And I was over there reading my Bible, and I was praying part of the time. I was praying, you know, God, if you want me to talk to this Muslim guy, please let him start the conversation, because, you know, I don't want people, you know, accusing me of, you know, attacking Muslims or something like that. And not long after that, Nabil said, so are you a hardcore Christian? And I said, I said, yes, I am. And, so we got into the conversation and really spent a lot of that weekend discussing Christianity and Islam. And Nabil explained all of his beliefs about Islam, that Islam was proven true by history and science and logic and reason and everything else. And he was just telling me that Islam was proven true in so many different ways. And, after he explained everything, I said, all right, you've explained everything you believe. Now I have a question. If you're wrong, do you want to know it? And Nabil, you know, gave an answer that's really revealed his heart. He said, yes and no. He said, yes, I'd want to know the truth about God, but no, it would destroy my family. And those have really always, through everything else that's happened, those have been Nabil's concerns. Yes, he wants to know the truth about God, and he will go wherever the truth points. But he's always got this tremendous love for his family, and trying to, you know, trying not to hurt them. And that's really been playing out his entire ministry.
So that was how you guys first met. Obviously, that turned into a friendship, though a friendship which was marked by frequent conversations, debates and arguments along the way. Just, I know it's a large story to condense, but would you give us a kind of potted history of what it was eventually that took Nabil down the road towards believing that Jesus was who he said he was and was raised from the dead?
It was about 2.5 years that we spent focusing mostly on Christianity. So we're focusing mostly on Christian topics. We were talking about, you know, the resurrection, Jesus' death, the deity of Christ, the Trinity, the reliability of the New Testament. And we're reading books on various topics and discussing them, going to debates, watching debates and so on, and going through the materials. And the sort of outcome of that was that Nabil realized that Christians have a good case for what we believe. But he didn't tell me until later that while even while he was thinking that, he would think, OK, they have a really good case for why they believe in Jesus' death and resurrection. They have a really good case for why they believe, you know, this or that. He said that even though he was thinking that, he was so confident in Islam that we still could never win a discussion. In other words, he believed that even if we show with 99% certainty that the New Testament is reliable, he's still 100% sure that Islam is true because of all the proof that Muslims have. And so eventually we started going into Islamic topics, examining the history of the Quran and the life of Muhammad. And of course, he did not know most of what we discussed because it is the information that you know he would get from his Muslim leaders is filtered for him. And so he was shocked at a lot of the material that he found about Muhammad and the Quran. And this came up. I started buying Islam sources, reading them, and then going to him and saying, "Hey, you said this about Islam. Sahih al-Bukhari says something different. Sahih Muslim says something different. What? How do you explain this?" And so that's when we started discussing Islam. And eventually, we got to a really difficult point where he didn't know what to believe. He Islam made sense to him, but he realized that Christians also have a good case. And so he was puzzled. And eventually, he prayed for God to guide him. He said, "God, you know, just show me and I'll do it." And that's when he started having dreams and visions telling him to leave Islam and to become a Christian. And eventually he did that.
Well, if you want to hear more about that story, it is all there on the interview I had with Nabil, which we're replaying on the Profile after today's program. And you can get as a podcast as well via the Profile podcast. So do make sure to download that if you want to hear more of that story. I mean, just I know that there were other people involved along the way, people like Mike Lacona, who's well known as a New Testament historian and an expert on the resurrection and so on, who, you know, it was one of those situations where there was opportunity for him to also have input and talk to Nabil about these issues. Ultimately, obviously, it must have been a wonderful day for you when Nabil finally bowed the knee to Jesus and you were able to be, yeah, part of his story there as well in the baptism as well. Do you want to just give us any memories you have of that particular day?
Oh, well, with the baptism, Nabil didn't want to tell his parents. And I thought it was important that he tell his parents just because, he had such an attachment and he just wanted to go on being a Christian without telling his parents. And I understand why Muslims would do that in certain parts of the world where, you know, they could be killed for becoming a Christian. But Nabil just, you know, kind of didn't want to hurt their feelings. And I knew he was going to have to do it and he didn't want to do it. And so I was telling him, "Hey, if I'm baptizing you, you need to tell your parents." And he said, "No, I'll tell them sometime, but not now." And I said, "No, you need to tell your parents." And I said, "All right, I'm going to pray that your parents find out." And I did. And his parents did. They came over to his house. They came over to his apartment and he wasn't there and they had a key and let themselves in and his computer was still open to this email exchange Nabil and I were having. And so they found out that he'd become a Christian, and then wow. So it was a difficult time for them, of course. And but he went through with the baptism, and it's funny because if you look at me in the pool, I'm actually back there thinking, "Cool, I'm done with Islam," because I really wasn't interested in Islam. I didn't like reading their sources. I was only doing it because my best friend was a Muslim and was trying to convince me that Islam was true. And so I'm thinking, "Hey, I'm done at last," and didn't turn out that way.
I mean, this was back in what, 2004, 2005, something like that?
Yeah, 2005.
Yeah. Obviously, since then, of course, your story has been very much on the trajectory of initially being in ministry with Nabil for a time with Acts 17 Apologetics and continuing that, of course, yourself with your speaking and videos and everything else that you do to engage with that. And in terms of how the story progressed, we know that Nabil went on to have a thriving ministry, both with you and then latterly with Azim, speaking around the world. What would you say was unique about his story and the way that obviously then engaged both with Christians, non-Christians and Muslims, of course?
Well, there are several factors. One, it was, you know, he had this intense love for his family. So that was Lots of Muslims can resonate with that, right? There are lots of Muslims who wouldn't. That's part of what keeps them in Islam, is they don't want to lose their families. Christians don't have to, and people who convert to Christianity don't have to deal with that much. But in the Islamic world, it's very, very often the case that if you leave Islam, you're giving up your family. And so lots of Muslims will pay attention to that. But what's also cool is that there are sort of multiple components to his conversion, that there's, you know, this intellectual investigation where he spends years going through the evidence for Christianity and going through the evidence for Islam. But also there's this spiritual component where he reached the end of, you know, his reasoning and couldn't figure it out. And then he starts getting some spiritual signs to guide him. And so you sort of put all of that together, and it does make an interesting, compelling story.
Yeah, absolutely. One which I know is obviously available still to be read in his best-selling book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. But he was also, of course, wrote a couple of other books as well in his time as well, important contributions to the whole area of Islam and Christianity. It was devastating, I'm sure, for him and for you and all those who loved him and were close to him, to hear of his diagnosis last summer. I know that he'd been having some stomach issues, but had sort of not put much in it. But when he did finally obviously go and get it checked out, the diagnosis was advanced stomach cancer. How did you react to that? How did you see him reacting to that? Obviously, what was devastating news, but I suppose at that point still one where there was hope that you know, God might provide some kind of healing or medical intervention could help. What was your reaction yourself, David?
Well, it was obviously it was a total shock, and you know, when you're thinking about not only what Nabil had accomplished, but the potential for accomplishing more. I mean, he had just finished his master's work at Oxford and was going on to his, you know, get a doctorate at Oxford. He already had a medical doctorate. He had three books. He was going to put out two more. And so he was obviously going to have a long career of amazing, not just apologetics works, but also, you know, scholarly work in New Testament, in the field of New Testament studies. And so,
and he had a wife and child on top of that, of course.
Yeah, he has a young daughter, and it was bad. It was really bad because about the same time, his wife Michelle became pregnant again and had a miscarriage right after the cancer diagnosis, and so. It was a very difficult time for him and his family, but with all that said, he was in very good spirits about everything when we would talk.
He was hopeful. He was positive.
Yeah, he back then, if you watch his videos, it was, you know, hey, I'm seeking healing and so on. But when we're talking on the phone, he was. Really, no matter what happened, he was fine. And this sort of didn't come out in his videos until the end. But all the way in his videos, he's just talking about, you know, God healing him and praying for God to heal him. But when we were having discussions early on, it was always, hey, if I get healed, I'm gonna keep praying for healing and ask everyone to pray for healing. But you know, if not, then, you know, go be with the Lord. And so he was always doing well behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, that, as you say, very came up through certainly in his latter videos as well, that he, I think, in many times beautifully expressed his faith and hope in Christ, that whatever the outcome, he had faith in Christ, that he knew that Christ held his future, whether it was still on earth or with Christ. I think for anyone, that's a model of Christian faithfulness and witness in times of darkness. Nevertheless, many Christians will have had the same sort of experience of asking why, you know, a man in his youth with so much potential. It did feel like we were only seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of the kind of influence that Nabil could have across the apologetics world, but the Muslim world. And obviously, it feels like if there was any candidate to receive, you know, a miraculous healing, it might have been him. It's very hard to offer answers in this area where we are so limited in our knowledge, David. But what would you say to the Christian who's asking why couldn't we have seen Nabil continue for many years to come?
Yeah, well, I'm not crazy on trying to do short discussions of that topic because, you know, if you're getting into the, you know, if we get into the problem of evil, it's a very difficult topic. But we do have, you know, we do have some biblical guidance here, even going back to the Old Testament. If you read the book of Job, the sort of overarching advice of the book of Job is actually a couple pieces. One, there's, you see this, you know, discussion beforehand about why this is going on. And Job never knows this. Job doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. And so there is that component that we don't always know what's going on behind the scenes. We don't always know what the reasons are, even if there are reasons behind the scenes. But as far as the kind of theodicy that Job offers is that the challenge put forward is, if you're serving God, why are you serving God? Are you serving God because you get lots of stuff and you have a wonderful life and you get this really, you know, good fortune in your life? Or are you serving God because he's God? And that's the challenge put forward. And notice, we don't really know whether someone is serving God because God blesses him and gives him stuff, or if that person really serves God just because, you know, God, you know, Jesus is Lord. And the idea put forward in Job is that if we don't go through a lot of stuff, a lot of bad stuff, we never really know. Mm. And so I'm not saying that's the explanation there. I'm saying as far as how things play out in the history of the church and the history of the world is that if things always went right when you became a Christian, if you became a Christian and you got lots of money and you were always taken care of and you didn't catch any diseases and everything went right for you, then why would people become Christians? They wouldn't become Christians because Jesus is Lord. They become Christians because, hey, this is how you get lots of stuff and this is the way to have no pain in your life and to never catch a disease. And so to me, it's always seemed that we have to be able, God has to allow lots of, now, Christians to go through stuff. Now, of course, God can heal and I believe that happens. But at the same time, Christians have to go through the same kinds of things that everyone else goes through, or people would be converting to Christianity for completely wrong, selfish motives. And so when I see Nabil suffering the way he did, it's always in the back of my mind that as much as I would like God to heal him and believe that God could have healed him, I also believe that Christians have to go through this stuff to demonstrate their faith to the world and to show that we serve Jesus no matter what we go through. And it's not because we're going to be blessed by him in some material or physical way. We serve him because he's Lord.
And I think to some extent for me, perhaps the greatest example Nabil showed beyond any his intellectual acumen and the amazingness of his story was that he was prepared to make the hardest decisions when it came to his family initially when he converted to Christianity, but also that in the face of, you know, that outcome and that suffering, he was still entirely faithful to his God and to trusting in him, which I think is an amazing testimony and legacy to leave behind. Were you able to communicate with him much in his final days, David?
I went down there a couple months ago and spent several days with him and another friend named Alex, and then my wife went down there, I think about 2 weeks ago to visit him. And so for the month or so leading up to his death, his parents were down there, and I know that they're not crazy. So I had messaged him and I said, hey, I know your parents are with you and I really don't want to, I really don't want to upset them in any way or cause any conflict. So if you want me to come down, let me know. I'll be on the next plane. But other than that, we can communicate by, by, email.
Well, thank you for everything that, that you meant to Nabil. And our prayers are going out for you and those others he's left behind, obviously Michelle and Aya, his direct family, and of course his wider family as well, who I'm sure are still processing what this all means for them. Is there, I understand that there's some kind of a GoFundMe as well for people who are interested in support, continuing to see. I think it was originally set up to fund his medical sort of issues, but now it's being, the fund is being used to support Michelle and Aya going forward. So people can find that, I think, just by looking up GoFundMe and Nabil Qureshi. David, for the moment, thank you very much for spending some time with us to talk about Nabil. Any final words in terms of, you know, those who are left thinking, what next? You know, Nabil's gone. It does remind us all of our mortality. I guess any final thoughts on what we can take from his life and his legacy?
Well, I mean, the awesome thing is, you know, even though he only lived to be 34 years old, he did get his testimony out there. He did get to discuss you know, jihad in his book on jihad, and he did get to do his detailed comparison between Christian theology and Islamic theology. So and that's the wonderful part, with all the lectures and sermons recorded and then the books out there, is that I think Nabil will be having a lasting impact for a long time.
Thank you for joining me, David. Thank you.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks for joining me on Unbelievable this week. And just a couple of reminders that we've got that special event coming up, Unbelievable Christian Skeptic Discussion Group, where I'll be on Monday the 9th of October, 7:30 to 9:30 at Summerstown Coffee House in 60 Cholton Street, London, between King's Cross and Euston, for that evening, talking about why I'm still a Christian on the back of my new book. So if you'd like to come along, do check out the meetup.com website for more details. The Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group is what you're looking for. The book available, of course, from unbelievablebook.co.uk. Do stick around if you can for the profile. We're re-airing that special interview I had 18 months ago with Nabil Qureshi to commemorate his life and memory as a witness to Jesus. Available as a podcast as well. Do check that out. Worth downloading and looking up if you can. An amazing story. For the moment, thanks for being with me, and let me finish by telling you what's coming up on the programme next week.
You're unbelievable.
Should be a feisty one, because I'm going to be joined in person by Andrew Copson from Humanists UK, author of a new book on secularism, and Peter Hitchens, the opinionated Mail on Sunday journalist, who is going to be coming in to do battle with him. Look out for that on your podcast or on your radio set at the same time next week. For the moment, thanks for being with me here on Unbelievable, and have a good week.
Lo sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras. Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en lowes.com/garantía-precios-bajos.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion, or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.